From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Last year, when describing the worst-case scenarios of the coronavirus pandemic, government scientists warned that we could see deaths numbering between 100,000 to 240,000. That range, predicted 10 months ago, was considered a grim projection. Now, more than 400,000 Americans have died from the coronavirus. On his first day in office, incoming President Joe Biden pledged to take strong action on the pandemic that includes strict mask wearing, streamlining the availability and distribution of vaccines, and much needed federal leadership and coordination of the pandemic response. While this represents a stark departure from the past president, scientists say it is still not nearly enough. One of them is my guest, Professor Yanir Bar-Yam, founding president of the New England Complex Systems Institute, where he's an expert on pandemics and other complex systems. He works with a COVID action group. He's the author of two books, a textbook called Dynamics of Complex Systems and Making Things Work, which applies complex systems science to solving problems in healthcare, education, systems engineering, international development, and ethnic conflict. Welcome to the program, Professor Bar-Yam.
Thank you.
So first, why do we need to take a sort of mathematical approach to the pandemic? And what does it mean to have the sort of complex systems approach?
The main thing is actually to identify what are the control variables that we have, right? If you want to be able to drive a car, you need to know that you have a steering wheel and gas and brakes and a gear shift. But if you don't know that, then you might be sitting in the back seat or someplace else and not know what you're actually doing in order to control it. And the same thing really applies to the pandemic. The control variables that we have that are really important are actually travel restrictions. We really need to have travel restrictions in order to control it, because then we can use a divide and conquer strategy where we separate zones and we can enable zones that are free of the disease to open up safely without having the risk of having new outbreaks in them. So having the ability to control travel is really crucial.
So when you say variables, I suppose we have to look at the fact that we're talking about millions of people who interact with one another, who spread the disease to one another with differing responses within one another. Each of them have their own health systems or their own personal health status, different access to healthcare, different geography. It is an incredibly complex system that even if one part is ignored, one can sort of lose sight of the whole, right?
That's right. But when we look at the large behavior of the system, it's actually only controlled by a few variables, right? Because we know, for example, we've been talking a lot about R, the transmission rate. And if the transmission rate is above one, then it grows exponentially. And if the transmission rate is below one, it declines exponentially. And if we do that with a rapid decline, then within a short period of time, we can actually get to zero and eliminate the virus. So the point is that knowing what these control variables are actually enables us to do the right thing, even when the system is a very, very complicated or complex social system that is very hard to talk about all the details. And the important part of all of this is to realize that even though our system is very complex, if we talk to people in an appropriate language, we say, look, it would only take about 4 to 6 weeks to have the number of cases dramatically decline in many parts of the country or a state, if a state chose to do this, to open up, to start opening up without any disease, then people will actually do that. And that's been shown in many, many different kinds of societies, ranging from Western democracies, Australia and New Zealand, to Asian countries, Taiwan and Thailand and Vietnam and China, but also in countries in Africa and even in Atlantic Canada, where they have almost no cases because they've acted aggressively, proactively, decided that the purpose of their response effort was to get rid of the virus, and had been successful in doing exactly that.
Is this why also, in particular, island nations and islands have managed, if they've restricted travel, to control the virus? So I'm thinking of New Zealand. I'm thinking of some of the Hawaiian Islands early on in the pandemic, although now, of course, they are open to tourism. When you have a finite geographic space that you can, especially with a very clear border, such as the edge of your land, to control, you can actually stop transmission.
That's right. It's easier on an island, but it's not as hard as people think. Right, Australia has an area which is larger than the continental United States. It has 8 states with major metropolitan areas separated by state boundaries, not that different from the United States in that regard. And so the idea that somehow Australia is like an island doesn't really make sense any more than it makes sense to talk about Vietnam with many millions of people as being an island, and it's not an island. So the point is that it is true that there are things that make it easier and harder, but it is not true that it is so difficult that it cannot be done. It really requires first a decision. The decision is that we want to get rid of the virus. And I know that early on in the outbreak, people were saying, maybe it won't be so bad, but then it became bad. And then people said, well, maybe we can't do what it takes. But then it took a very long time for people to realize that it wasn't going to get better. And now we know that the situation is very severe. It's very likely to get worse. In fact, we know it will get worse because of the new variant that came from the UK and perhaps other ones from South Africa. And really the point is that there is no point in time where it's not worthwhile to get rid of this within a period of 5 to 6 weeks. So if we start now taking really strong action, much of the country would actually be cleared of the disease in about 4 weeks, and a lot of it, even most of it, if not all of it, would be cleared by 6 weeks. And then we could start getting back to normal within a few more weeks, just being careful how we reopen. And it wouldn't be this halfway reopening where you have to shut down and open up and hospitals overflowing and all of that stuff. It would really be a normal reopening, a pre-pandemic reopening, which is what people are experiencing in Australia almost all the time. Sometimes once in a while, there's a couple of cases here or a couple of cases there and they stop it. But it doesn't take a lot of time and it doesn't disrupt lives the way what we're doing is disrupting our lives.
Where does a vaccine fit into all of this? The new year began with a lot of hope on the horizon, as well as a lot of mourning for the lives lost. And many Americans have been now led to believe, just maybe by media coverage and of course by many leaders, that the deaths we're experiencing now are the worst of it, with the vaccine being delivered, 14 million people being vaccinated already, although not fast enough, that's the path to normalcy.
So the vaccine rollout will take 6 to 12 months. In the meantime, we're losing 3,000 to 4,000 lives per day. And that actually, people say that this is the worst of it. But again, if the new variant that is, rampaging in England and UK, and
one was even found in California.
There are a number of cases here, and the point is that people say, okay, so now it's here. So what are we going to do about it? But the answer is, if we act strongly now, it won't be able to grow to overcome. We know that in the UK and in Ireland have been successful at getting even the new variant to decline exponentially. So rather than waiting until it overwhelms us, and when I say overwhelms us, it's really worth remembering our hospitals are already overflowing in many places and care is being limited. But this variant multiplies by about a factor of 2 every 10 days compared to the transmission of the previous dominant variant, the one that we have dominant in the United States now. So in a few weeks, in March, if we don't do anything now, all of a sudden our cases will start multiplying by a factor of two every 10 days. So it'll overwhelm the hospitals by twice over and by four times over and by eight times over. That's quite horrendous. And so it can get a lot worse. So the answer is that every time we ask the question about what we should do, and we say, well, it's really bad and it's really hard to do something about it, but we wait longer and it becomes really worse and even harder to do something about it. So the answer really is to act fast and soon so that we can get rid of the virus and get back to normal life.
Now, you're dashing a lot of hopes among our audiences who, especially, you know, parents who were hoping that their children could go back to school maybe in a few weeks or a few months. What happens when one starts to, say you close down for the 4 weeks you were suggesting, maybe 5 weeks, completely very strict shutdown, you know, for a population already weary of being shut in, especially those who've taken the trouble to observe quarantine voluntarily, this sounds, you know, kind of disheartening. But then reopening, wouldn't that simply restart the virus circulating again? I mean, we certainly can't be closed indefinitely.
No. So actually, that's really the point. That, and for those who are already observing restrictions, it's not adding much, right? It's the realization that everyone should have that by acting on a community basis to stop the transmission, that community by community can open up. And the way they open up safely is exactly what I said earlier, is applying travel restrictions. And this is what works. And this is what's worked in many places, even within an urban area. If you set a boundary and say, okay, we're not going to travel across this boundary except for essential travel. And if people have to come in from outside, you have to do 14-day quarantines. And we've heard this story before in many places already. And travel restrictions are even in place in California. The limit is too large, but the idea of it is present. So if we use the travel restrictions between towns, between cities, between neighborhoods of a city, then what we can do is we open up each area as it becomes free of the virus. And it doesn't take that long again. It just takes a few weeks. So the key is realizing that if you go all out, what you want to do is not to have as much open as possible, which is what we've been doing. You know, trying to figure out, can I leave malls open? Can I leave restaurants open for indoor dining or outdoor dining or something else? Can we have this or that? Maybe schools can be open or maybe something else. No. What you do is you say, we're going to stop it. And once we stop it, it's at zero community transmission. Then we can open up normally, safely. It's like putting out a fire. You don't put out a fire part way and walk away from it. You put out the fire. And then maybe there's another fire in the future. So you put that one out. But you can open up normally and act and behave in the normal way with having family occasions, normal economic activity, going to restaurants and sports events and going to churches and any other activity that you want to do in the normal way. And that's what's happening again in Australia.
And in fact, other countries are restricting travel from the US because of how many infected people we have. Had this action plan been taken up a year ago, or I should say 10 months, 9 months ago, would we have been in this position?
No, we would have been clear of the disease. We would have been, hopefully, not only clear of the disease, we would have been helping other countries to get to clear of the disease, and the world would be an entirely different place.
So we did have very serious restrictions, right? We had California shutting down after New York was in, was raging. Are you saying that those restrictions, had they been more airtight, had they been more comprehensive, had they been stricter, would have worked, and that in retrospect, the sacrifices that people did make were for naught?
That's right. Well, I mean, they did help at the time to reduce the number of cases, but we didn't follow through. So you have to go all the way to zero in order to benefit from it and then open up normally. And it's very straightforward, right? Because if you stop and you leave virus in the community, it's going to grow again. And so the real problem was that people didn't set the goal of elimination. We call it now COVID zero. The goal of elimination means that we're paying attention to when we get to zero and we open up when we get to zero. And the reason that that's super important is because it motivates us to do it. And we can understand why we're doing it. And we can benefit even if one town does it and another town doesn't do it. The ones that do it will benefit. And then the other ones will learn that it was worthwhile.
You said earlier that Australia has a landmass larger than the US. It isn't about just simply having a small island that one can close off to travel. But at some point, there is a limit to the geographic area that you're limiting travel from, right? I mean, or are you suggesting that any country with national boundaries can do this regardless of the size of the country?
Yeah, I mean, Atlantic Canada, which is just four provinces of Canada, had a travel bubble between them. Right now, they have a small outbreak that they're gaining control over, but they're part of Canada. They had their own green zone area where there was no transmission in the community, and they had travel between those areas. And they even took part of Quebec that was free of the virus and added it to their green zone bubble. So what we want to do is just be focused on getting to zero and then progressively open larger and larger areas. And we can combine countries. Of course, we start by communities, neighborhoods, cities, and then, you know, we add to it to the level of states and then countries. But that process happens quite quickly. Again, it's not a long time. We've been doing this now for almost a year, and it's hard to imagine that in 4 to 6 weeks, we could be out of this and starting a return back to normal life.
And China is the world's most populous nation. And I remember a time last year when the Chinese government was racing to control a small, you know, sort of resurgence of the disease in Wuhan, and we're freaking out over few dozen or 100 cases of infection at the same time when there were tens of thousands of cases per day in the United States, and you didn't see nearly that level of alarm here in the US. And it just makes you wonder if we've sort of normalized or become numb to the amount of death that we're experiencing here in the United States. And of course, this isn't to negate the, going back to the issue of the vaccine, billions of our tax dollars were put into developing those vaccines, and with new variants coming online, where does the vaccine fit into it? I mean, in 4 to 6 weeks, if the country observed a strict shutdown, and then eventually in several months, would a complete vaccination still be necessary?
So the vaccine becomes a tool. It becomes one of the powerful tools that we have to prevent transmission and to help us stay in a normal existence. And the point is that, sure, it's super important, but to rely on it as the only tool is very unwise. And it's very unwise for multiple reasons. Number one is that it's going to take us a while to be able to vaccinate a large percentage of the population. And number two, because the virus, as we know, is not standing still, it's mutating. And the more virus we have, the more mutants we have. And the more mutants we have, the more likely, in fact, it's extremely likely, that there will be some of those that will be able to evade the immune system response that we have gotten from the vaccine. Because we already have some mutants that are significantly different from the original coronavirus that we started with. And as we're not tracking all of the mutants out there. So the challenge is that we end up with so many different mutants and so many different varieties that they will evade this vaccine. So what will we do? We'll have to develop another vaccine and another vaccine. And that's what we do with the flu. And the flu is something that we live with for year to year. And it causes a lot of harm. The coronavirus, if we lived with it from year to year, it would cause a lot more harm and it would cause a lot of harm both to lives and to the economy.
Right. We already know that the death toll from the coronavirus, COVID-19, is significantly higher from the flu. Let me ask you about the fact that we were told last year that we had to choose between having a vibrant economy and eradicating the disease, and of course the Trump administration chose to prioritize the economy, and then because the disease resurged and so many people died, we have not even, of course, saved the economy. Both are falling apart. Still, for small businesses in particular, a 4 to 6 week closure, strict closure, is very likely a death sentence. So how do you advise President Joe Biden on eradicating the disease while preserving the livelihoods, especially of working Americans?
The main thing is that it is a short amount of time. And right now we're preparing for an economic disaster of 9 months, according to the current bill that is planned to be enacted, $1.9 trillion. And if we think about using that for a period of 5 weeks plus a few weeks of process of gradually opening up, it's really much less harm to go strong, go fast, get rid of the virus, and open up and allow the economy to recover rather than trying to support it in a halfway for 9 months. The short-term solution makes sense. And what we need to do is to support everyone, to support the people who need support, companies that need the support, because it's a short time and it's just a bridging process to enable us to get past.
We could pay people to stay home.
And exactly the point, which is that however you think about it, whether you're supporting their needs or paying people to stay home, it's only a short amount of time that we have to invest in order to get a tremendous return of returning back to normal. Again, no one would ever think of putting out a fire part way and then walking away from it and letting it burn your house down.
What you want to do is put it out. Tell me about the open letter that you and your colleagues wrote to Joe Biden, and whether anything in Biden's plan to tackle the coronavirus resembles what you've advised him to do.
So the main thing is that we surely applaud, improving the use of masks, improving the vaccinations. Vaccines should be as rapidly as possible used to prevent harmful disease. We don't know exactly what they'll do with infections, but surely to prevent harmful disease, severe disease in vulnerable people. The point, however, is the following, that what we're still doing is we're thinking in terms of mitigation, making it a little bit less bad, instead of saying what we want is elimination, which is getting rid of it and going back to normal.
Wouldn't mask wearing help? I mean, that's one of the things that Joe Biden has put his stock in, a strict mask wearing period.
It helps, but it is not enough. It's not enough in the sense that it won't result in a rapid decline in number of cases. What really results in a rapid decline in the number of cases is for people to stay away from each other. Hmm. You cannot get infected if you don't get near other people who are infected. And since you don't know who is infected, because they can be asymptomatic, pre-symptomatic, before they get the symptoms of the disease, you want to stay away from them. And if you stay away, we do that, even for a few weeks, then the disease goes away. It dies, because the only way it survives is by transmitting from person to person.
Now, there was a piece recently published, I believe it was in Nature, about how the SARS-CoV, how coronavirus could eventually become endemic once enough herd immunity has been achieved either through natural infection or through vaccination. And the scientists who wrote that piece, of course, recommended vaccination because the death rate to achieving that immunity, that level of immunity, is far, far lower. What do you make of that?
The whole idea of an endemic disease is accepting that it circulates in the population. And there are a lot of people who focus on human diseases. And part of the challenge that we have is that in the West, in US and in Europe, there hasn't been a lot of action in recent years on elimination. Elimination is something that is very focus in Africa, of course, where there are more zoonotic outbreaks that happen from diseases that come from animals. And also SARS in Asia, it did come to Canada briefly for a small amount of time, but it was mostly in Asia. It gave a warning there that they had to prepare themselves to stop diseases. And so the reaction in Asia was a reaction that was arose because people had reacted to SARS and it stopped it. So there are many diseases that we've worked on elimination. And elimination in general uses both social distancing, staying away from people, and vaccination. So they work together as part of that process. I don't think, and I think that many other people, I think, would agree that having a disease that's as severe as SARS-2, the coronavirus infection, is something that we don't want to have in our society. And we've spent many years, many decades, getting rid of the worst diseases that we had 100 years ago. And that's why today we have vaccines. But a lot of the work that was done to get rid of them was not just vaccination. So the point of all of this is that if we make a decision, if we really go all out, we can get rid of this disease, not allow it to become endemic, not allow it to continue to harm our lives and harm our economy. But it's really mostly a question of making a decision. Making a decision that will require a lot of effort, a lot of hard work over a few weeks, but it's surely much better than continuing what we've been doing for the last 10 months.
It might actually get our kids back to school sooner than what we're doing now.
100%. It will get the kids back to school sooner. And again, this is one of these things where you say short-term pain is long-term gain. It's not that bad. We've done it. We've been doing it mostly. We've been kind of shut down a lot of the last 10 months. What we really just have to do is to make a decision that we're going to make this shutdown the last shutdown and make the most of it and get the benefit of getting to zero.
Finally, give out a website, Professor Bariam, for where people can find out more about this this work that you've been talking about.
Sure. If you want to help, we're surely welcome, and there's a lot of information. And one of the websites is covidzero.us. That's covidzero.us. And then there is the covidactiongroup.net, which is the scientific advisory group that we have. And there is a much larger global volunteer effort at endcoronavirus.org. So the first one was covidzero.us, the second one was covidactiongroup.net, and the third is endcoronavirus.org. And I look forward to everyone participating and having us get rid of this disease.
We'll post links to all of those from our website later today. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
My guest has been Professor Yanir Bariam, founding president of the New England Complex Systems Institute, where he's an expert on pandemics and other complex systems. He works with the COVID Action Group. And we've been discussing the way in which we can get rid of this virus through strict measures. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.